Hey there, this is Captain Jeff, the Airline Pilot Guy. You're listening to the Airline Pilot Guy podcast. Hello again, and welcome back to the Airline Pilot Guy podcast. This is episode number 3, and I'm in Washington, D.C., not too far from the Washington Mall, not the shopping mall, but, you know, the place with the White House and the Capitol building, etc. And anyway, it's hot here today. It's Wednesday, the 8th of June, and we're experiencing a heat wave up here in Washington, D.C., and well, actually, most of the country is experiencing a heat wave. Anyway, I'm nice and cool in my hotel room here. I've turned off my air conditioning unit, though, so that there isn't that background noise. So things are starting to warm up here in the room, but that's okay. It's still pretty nice and comfortable. Anyway, I'm on another four-day trip, or another trip. This time it's a four-day trip. I'm on day 3, and I don't want this show to become just a show about, you know, talking about aviation in the news. But I do want to keep track of a couple things that I am very interested in, and I'm sure that you are as well. One of which is the Air France Flight 447 that went down about 2 years ago, June of 2009. And I talked about that in the last podcast. And I found something quite interesting, an article that was in Der Spiegel, online, or the Der Spiegel magazine, which is a German magazine, I think much like Time or Newsweek, that kind of thing, a news magazine. And let's see, this is by Gerald Traufetter. Hope I'm pronouncing that right. And the name of the article is Doomed Flight AF-447, Questions Raised About Airbus Automated Control System. And let's see, of course, in the article, he recaps what happened, and it only took 3.5 minutes or so for the whole nightmare to happen, where the airplane was up at 35,000 feet, climbs to 38,000 feet, and then, of course, drops dramatically for that 3.5 minutes down to the icy Atlantic, killing, well, I don't know if it was icy, but the Atlantic Ocean, killing all 228 people on board. And the interesting thing about his article is that he has a quote here from Gerard Hüttig, and this is something that has kind of bugged me about this whole thing, the interim report that we received with a little bit of information regarding the flight data recorder and the voice recorder, and something that just doesn't strike me as true, or not true, but something is just not right. I mean, why would three highly experienced aviators be putting the wrong control inputs into this airplane, doing basically the opposite of what they should have been doing to recover the airplane from this high altitude stall? And Gerard Hüttig, a professor at the Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics at the Technical University in Berlin, considers the high angle of the horizontal stabilizer to be a failure of the Airbus's electronic flight control system. Hüttig, a former Airbus pilot himself, okay, so he has a little bit of credibility, calls it, quote, a programming error with fatal consequences. Okay, right now, Air France and Airbus are kind of, you know, battling each other and that are butting heads together because one is blaming the other for this accident. And it seems that Gerard Hüttig, the professor at the Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics at the Technical University in Berlin, is hinting that perhaps it is some kind of an automation error, not necessarily just a crew error. I'll continue with the article. No matter how hard the crew tried to push down the nose of the aircraft, they would have had no chance, Hüttig says. He is demanding that the entire fleet of Airbus 330s be grounded until the phenomenon is adequately explained. The BEA report in its current form only provides the angle of the stabilizer, but provides no explanation as to why. The report merely indicates that it was at this moment that Captain Marc Dubois re-entered the cockpit. Exactly what orders he issued are not part of last Friday's report, but sources close to the investigation are saying that he said, "This is a stall, reduce power, and nose down." Okay? I'm not sure, you know, reducing power and putting the nose down would have been, you know, I would have probably added power and put the nose down to get some more flow over the wing and reduce the angle of attack, etc. But anyway, obviously he knows that they're in a stall, and he's telling them to push the nose down. This order would have been the correct one were the situation not already hopeless, but by this time the jet was already pointing steeply downwards, and it was already losing vertical altitude, at a rate of 200 kilometers per hour. The passengers who had a short time before been pressed into the backs of their seats were now being held into their seats only by their seat belts. At this moment, I would have feared for my life even if I was sitting in the passenger cabin, said one A330 pilot after reading the report. That the plane was in a free fall would have been clear to all on board. The nose of the plane pointed skyward at an angle of 16 degrees. That's more than immediately following takeoff, the pilot said. In its report, the BEA has only published statements from the pilots that contain information about technical matters. I don't have any more indications, said the co-pilot Bonin, for example. 1.5 minutes of free fall later, he said, we're going to arrive at level 100. That means that the plane is only 3,000 meters above sea level. The last minutes of Air France Flight 447 must have been especially tragic for Captain Dubois. The rules do, of course, stipulate that the captain can rest in the rest area or the rear area of the airplane during this phase of flight. But why did he not remain in the cockpit until they passed through the storm? This is just, again, a speculation by the writer of this article. Let's see. Let me skip ahead here to the thing that really interested me. And this is Captain Jeff speaking. Why were all the crew's efforts in the cockpit in vain? Did the plane no longer react to the cockpit commands as it fell? Or did the horizontal stabilizer, which was still almost fully deflected at 13 degrees, continue to force the nose of the airplane up? Airbus vehemently denies that the plane's automatic controls could have worked against the pilot's commands. Were the suspicions proven true, however, then the software would have to be replaced in over 1,000 Airbus 330s and its sister model, the A340. The costs would run into hundreds of millions of euros. So, was it really the stabilizer that doomed the pilots? In theory, they could have still adjusted it. Its position can be manually altered using a wheel near the thrust levers. But as Hudig notes, one would first have to know that the stabilizer is deflected. Hudig pointed out that Airbus published a detailed explanation of the correct behavior in the event of a stall in the January issue of its internal safety magazine. This year, I guess, January. And there, all of a sudden, they mention manually trimming the stabilizers. So, you know, it still remains an open question, and one wonders whether or not this stabilizer trimmed all the way back at 13 degrees nose up was indeed a major cause of why they couldn't get the nose of the airplane back down and get out of the stall. So, very interesting, I think. And it kind of gives maybe, I don't know, it helps me understand why this seasoned crew of three just couldn't seem to get the airplane out of this high-speed stall. So I'll keep you up to date on any updates on this story and if the stabilizer has anything to do with this. In a related story, and you know how I feel about automation. I think automation is fantastic. It is definitely important that we have automation in aircraft. But we have to understand what limitations there are to using automation. And I saw this article published in Flight Global or flightglobal.com by David Learmount. And the title of the study is, or the article is, FAA Study Finds Serious Flaws in Pilot Training for Handling Automation. A significant emerging study suggests that flight crews have never been properly trained for operating highly automated aircraft, and that for many of the problems they have to deal with, there are no checklists, leaving the pilots to manage using ingenuity and airmanship. Inadequate crew knowledge of automated systems was a factor in more than 40% of accidents and 30% of serious incidents between 2001 and 2009. Delegates at the November 2nd through 5th Flight Safety Foundation International Aviation Seminar, or Safety Seminar in Milan, Italy, were told. And the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration's 1996 landmark report on interfaces between flight crews and modern flight deck systems is in the process of being dramatically updated, potentially with far greater implications for change than the original. Let's see. FAA human factors specialist Dr. Kathy Abbott cataloged the evidence of disharmony between crews and their highly automated aircraft. The study is based on accident and incident data and line operation safety audits over the period between 2001 and 2009. Dr. Kathy Abbott adds the caveat that she is presenting raw data at this point, and there's much more work yet to do to understand it fully. Let's see. Among the recurring handling problems pilots demonstrate, Abbott's findings include lack of recognition of autopilot or autothrottle disconnect, lack of monitoring and failure to maintain energy/speed, incorrect upset recovery, inappropriate control inputs, and dual sidestick inputs. Regarding flight management system use, she found that pilots frequently focused on programming the FMS to the detriment of monitoring the flight path. Yeah, this emphasis on using the flight management system can lead to a distraction, that you know you're not paying attention to what's going on with the airplane. Let's see, there are many failures with which the pilots have to deal with, little or no help from checklists or training of any kind. These include failures or malfunctions of air data computers, software failures, electrical failures, uncommanded autopilot disconnects, or pitch-up for which the reason is not known. Again, back to the Air France 447 accident. The airplane was pitching up. It didn't seem like they could get the nose of the aircraft down to recover from that stall. Let's see. Failure assessment is difficult. Failure recovery is difficult. And the failure modes were not anticipated by the designers. Despite the sometimes fickle nature of the automation, she observes, pilots frequently abdicate too much responsibility to automated systems. The reasons for this, she found, include a perceived lack of trust in pilot performance by the airline, policies that encourage use of automated systems rather than manual operations, and insufficient training, experience, or judgment, the result of which is that pilots may not be prepared to handle non-routine situations. Okay, again, this is just backing up what I really truly feel. I see this trend. You know, I've been flying in the airlines for more than 22 years now, and flying in the airline or the aviation world, obviously flying in the aviation world, that's a dumb statement, sorry, for almost 30 years. I'm seeing something that is really concerning me. A lot of the pilots I fly with almost exclusively fly the airplane through the autopilot system. And when they do actually manipulate the controls, their pilot skills don't seem to be up to par, or they're not finely honed, I guess we could say. So I'm seeing this reliance on the automation as something that is being encouraged by airline management, by the airline training departments. I know that in my particular airline, in my particular airplane, there is just an almost, I don't know what to call it, this insistence that we use these automated systems almost exclusively. And I don't know. It's just, again, I think that their use is important. They are a tool that we have available to us to use. Yes, I'm all about flying the airplane efficiently and saving fuel. You know, that's the bottom line. The airlines are not charities. They're in business to make money. But I also feel it's very important for me to provide the best experience possible for my passengers on my flights. And if this automated system is flying the airplane in what I consider not a smooth manner, then I'm not going to use it. I'll use it as far as I can, and to enhance efficiency as much as possible. But As soon as it starts doing some weird maneuvers, like you know, making you feel light in your seat or whatever, I'm firing that system and going back to how I know how to fly the airplane smoothly and comfortably and safely. So, just another interesting data point. Apparently, safety experts out there are seeing the same trend that I am. Okay. You know, the show, again, I don't want it to be strictly about news reports and stuff that's happening in the news. I do want to also bring in more stories about my experiences in my flying, mostly in the airline world, but also in the military world. And I was reading a book the other day. It's an excellent book by Len Morgan. Len Morgan was an airline pilot for Braniff. He was also a military pilot. And going back to my early days when I was very young and really interested in flying, I subscribed to Flying Magazine. I think I was maybe, 10 years old, 9 years old when I first subscribed to Flying Magazine. And one of the most interesting columns in Flying Magazine, the one that I would always go to either first or second, was the column written by Len Morgan. And I believe it was called Vectors. And I don't think they're in print anymore, but I found through Amazon.com, through some of the used bookstores, a couple volumes of books that had some of his columns compiled. And so I was just reading that the other day, and one of the articles was entitled "Because He's Got the Job." And it really talks about the environment of the cockpit and the working environment between the captain and the co-pilot and the flight engineer. I know nowadays we don't really have flight engineers anymore, or very few airplanes do. And, you know, I was reflecting on my 22-plus year career in the airlines and thought to myself, you know, I've been a captain now for about half of it. And, when I was first hired by Acme, the first position for Acme Airlines and for most of the big legacy airlines is the position of flight engineer. Now, some airlines, some of the big legacy airlines like Pan Am and some others, had the flight engineer position was actually a permanent or professional flight engineer position. So the guys that were flying in this position never proceeded or advanced to one of the flying positions. They were always going to be flight engineers, professional flight engineers. Many of them had private pilot's licenses, maybe commercial licenses, but knew that they would not be exercising the flying part of that for that particular airline. But most airlines like United and Delta and American, et cetera, the first position that you would get when you were hired as a pilot would be the non-flying position as a flight engineer. One of the frustrating things about being a flight engineer was that when people are getting on the airplane and they see you sitting in front of this panel with a little desk in front of you, and you're clearly sitting sideways, and you're not in one of the flying, the pilot positions, they think that you're a navigator. Well, navigators were gone long before I got hired by the airlines. And the flight engineer, you might ask what a flight engineer does. His or her job is to monitor the systems of the airplane, the fuel system, the electrical system, the hydraulic system, the pneumatic system, which is the air from the engines that power the air conditioning packs, and the pressurization system, etc. And that's because the airplanes that have flight engineer positions in general, are not as modern. They don't have all these automated systems for managing all these tasks. So that was the first position for most of these legacy airlines. And a lot of people that were hired by the airlines, had been flying for quite some time, had quite a bit of experience. Many of us coming out of the military, and many of us, being aircraft commanders, pilots in command for years, and now all of a sudden, not only are we not pilot in command, but we're sitting at this panel, and a lot of guys were frustrated by that. But I looked at it as a positive thing, because I was introduced to this new area, this new arena of flying, the airline world, and I thought this would be a perfect place to learn the ropes in the airline world. And so, you know, most of the time you'd fly with crews, co-pilots and captains that were great to fly with, and you'd have a great time. Occasionally, you'd fly with one or two people on the crew that were not very much fun to be with, and it usually had something to do with the captain. And that's what brings me to this whole discussion. You know, when we're hired by the airlines, at least at ACME, they told us, you know, we're not hiring you to be a flight engineer. We're not hiring you to be a co-pilot. We're hiring you to be a captain. And your job or your duty and obligation is to learn how to be a captain by flying with all these other captains that you're going to be flying with over all these years. For me, it was about 12 years of being a flight engineer and a co-pilot. And so that's what I did. I paid attention to my experience with these various captains throughout my 12 years. And one thing that I noticed was I kept track of most of the time I witnessed things and I kept a mental note to myself of I'm not going to do that when I'm a captain. And occasionally you'd fly with a captain who was just, you know, you thought, this is what I want to be. This is the way I want to manage the cockpit. This is the way I want to come across to my crew members. And, you know, I think it might be, well, let me tell you a little bit of a story here about, you know, one of my good friends. His father was a pilot for Acme Airlines and for like 35 years. And when I was a brand new flight engineer, I was very excited about mentioning this, my friend's father's name, because I knew that he must, you know, people must know him. And I figured that most of the captains I was flying with would be about the right seniority or about the right age to have flown with this captain. And the first time that I mentioned his name, the captain I was flying with on the 727 crew just about screwed himself into the ceiling. And he almost turned red in the face. And he was telling me how much he despised flying with this captain and what a jerk this guy was. And and I thought, wow, boy, that was a really strong reaction. And I'm thinking that this captain just must have had a personality conflict with my friend's father. So we went on with the trip, and then I think it was the next trip or maybe the trip thereafter, I thought I'd try it again. I said, hey, do you know, or did you ever fly with Captain, we'll call him Smith? And again, I got the same exact reaction. This guy just about screwed himself into the ceiling. And he started using all kinds of expletives and told me how not desirable it was to be on this man's crew. And he said it got so bad that, and this captain was the kind of guy who said basically, don't do anything unless I tell you to do it. Don't touch a switch. Don't make a radio call. Don't do anything. I'm in charge. I'm the captain. I'll tell you what to do, when to do, and when to do it. And he said it got so bad that the crews would actually hope that he would forget to call for the landing gear down and that they would land gear up. That's how bad the situation was. That's how unsafe a situation can get if you're in an atmosphere or you're flying with somebody who's like this, a tyrant. And interestingly, it seems that most of these tyrants, these people who are not fun to fly with, are that way because they're unsure of their own skills. In other words, they're not strong pilots. They doubt their own skills and their decision-making abilities. Now, let me read, and Len Morgan does it so much more eloquently than I can. Let me read a little bit out of his book, and I hope that I'm not you know, violating some kind of a copyright. And if I am, please somebody tell me so that I can stop doing this. But this is just too good. And this is an excerpt, fair use, from Reflections of a Pilot by Lynn Morgan. Let's see. Later, as a co-pilot, I flew with younger captains, practically all of whom were cordial working associates. A few aped the handful of hard-nosed seniors, forever reminding the world that they were God's special gifts to aviation. Every hour was a training hour with such boors, no matter what your background. Happily, they comprised a small percentage of the seniority list, but a month with a fellow who never stops reminding you he's in charge could be a longish 30 days. After 15 years as a flight engineer and a co-pilot in 8 airliner types, I concluded that next to professional skill, diplomacy is the most desirable attribute of an engineer or co-pilot. I'm not talking about bootlicking, I'm talking about working with a captain no matter what you think of him, because, as the counsel for the Kane Mutineers put it in the classic scene, because he's got the job. The pilot who goes into most multi-engine flying must serve an apprenticeship, sometimes a lengthy one, under the supervision of pilots who got there earlier. He may find himself teamed with a captain who's younger or less experienced or not quite sure of himself, and sooner or later, he is certain to find himself teamed with a left-seater who can only be summed up as a horse's posterior. The expert handling of such a misfit is part of the job. The name of the game is not winning friends, but flying safely. No one expects perfect weather every day, nor should he expect jolly companions every trip. Doing the job right, despite the weather, and regardless of who's in the other cockpit seats, is all that matters. Eventually, I made the left seat, and only then did I appreciate that many good captains I'd flown with. I came to realize it was their diplomacy, rather than mine, that had made our thousands of hours together safe and enjoyable. They respected me as a pilot and as an individual, and I worked my butt off for them. We solved some in-flight problems between us, a few quite hairy, because we worked well as a team when the chips were down. In a word, they were natural leaders who taught by example. They were in charge and had the final say at all times. That was always understood and indeed expected. They knew their jobs and assumed I knew mine. There was rarely a need for talk about who would do what next. Their approach reflected confidence in themselves and in their crews. It produced the best efforts from all of us every time and resulted in the relaxed cockpit atmosphere, which is as important as fuel in the tanks. A few captains never got the big picture. Some today don't have it. Oddly enough, most of the hardheads now giving their co-pilots and engineers bad times were the loudest beefers during their own right seat days. The left seat tyrant is likely unsure of himself. He needs expert assistance far more than the genial, relaxed type. Yet he does everything to discourage crew cooperation. He bears watching. Eventually, he will encounter a riddle he cannot solve all by himself, and that will be no time for his assistants to sit with hands folded and let him sweat. This has happened and can lead to disaster. During the investigation of a major airline accident in England, it was found that the captain and co-pilot had a heated argument prior to the flight. It's the captain's duty to insist on a relaxed cockpit atmosphere regardless of the different personalities involved. If he is so full of himself or so unsure of himself that he cannot or will not provide proper leadership, it is the co-pilot's and engineer's responsibility to see him for the mental dwarf he is and carry on the good work, each on his own. If they cannot work professionally in that unpleasant situation as the crewmen they hope to someday command, they are no more fit for the left seat than the clown who occupies it now. He's a great writer, and so true. He hit the nail on the head. The captains that have the nice, relaxed cockpits, they don't make a big deal of their skills, their flying skills, and their decision-making abilities. You know that they're in charge and that they solicit input from the rest of the crew, but when the chips are down and it comes to a final decision, you know that they're going to make it, and they're going to make the right decision. So, your comments. If you're a pilot, I'd be interested in what you think about all that, even if you're not a pilot. I know that a lot of this kind of interaction, human relations, is consistent or in common with many other areas and many other jobs. So I'd be interested to hear your comments about that. Okay. Speaking of hearing your feedback, you can send your feedback to feedback@airlinepilotguy.com, or you can dial 304 99 Pilot. And let's see, I have some feedback. Let me start with Joe Walsh sent me some feedback. I think he recorded this on his iPhone and then sent it to me to feedback at airlinepilotguy.com. Here we go.
Hey, Captain Jeff, it's Joe here in Dublin, Ireland. Just finished listening to your latest podcast. Thought it was great, as usual. It's good after so many years of touring and traveling on airplanes with the band to hear the stories from the other side of the cockpit door. So I just wondered, have you ever flown any vintage aircraft? It's something I've always been interested in. I just like looking at them. I think they're really graceful and stuff. Douglas Dakota and the Ford Tri-Motor, things like that. I wonder, have you ever flown one? Anyway, keep up the good work and let me know. Cheers. Bye.
Well, thanks, Joe, for the feedback. And vintage aircraft, no, I have never flown a vintage aircraft. Now, some of the airplanes, some of the airliners I've flown and some of the airplanes in the military, some might consider vintage. And I think just about every airplane I've flown so far, except the one I'm currently flying, has been retired from service. So that tells you something about how long I've been around. In fact, one of the questions my kids asked when I was displaced from the 727 to the MD-88 was, Dad, are they going to be retiring this airplane now? And they thought that was funny. But anyway, the closest I've been to a vintage airplane, other than in museums, are the DC-3s and the Beech 18s that we would take care of at the fixed base operation in Mobile called the Mobile Air Center. I worked there as a teenager during the summer times and Christmas breaks and that kind of thing. And I was a line boy there, which meant I was the guy that, you know, helped park airplanes and put fuel in the airplanes and oil and stacked the hangars and that kind of thing. At the Mobile Air Center at that time, we had a couple DC-3s that were based there, and or at least they were there quite often. I don't know if they were technically based there or not, but we took care of them, and I spent a lot of time crawling in and around and on top of the DC-3s, mostly on the wing and on top of the engine nacelle, pumping oil into those big radial engines. Those darn engines used, it almost seemed like they burned more oil than they did gas, avgas. But we would get the 55-gallon drum out and bring it out to the airplane and, you know, throw the hose up on top of the wing and try to climb up that oily wing on the top side of the wing and keep from falling off of it, because if you fell off the darn thing, it would not be good onto the concrete. And then pump gallons of oil into each of the engines. And anyway, it was a lot of fun. We enjoyed those beasts and going inside the airplane and sitting in the cockpit and pretending that we were flying it. But no, I never got a chance to actually get in the air in one of those things. But boy, I would welcome the chance to do that sometime. So no, unfortunately, I've not been able to fly any of those vintage aircraft. By the way, Joe is, you know, he mentioned he's from Dublin, and turns out that he's one of, now I'm going to read from his website, josephwalsh.com. He's one of Ireland's most experienced tenors. In a career spanning 15 years, he has sung on television in Germany, Italy, Ireland, and coast to coast in the United States, as well as appearing on stage in over 20 different countries, culminating in a St. Patrick's Day performance on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., attended by President George W. Bush, Irish Prime Minister Bertie Ahern, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, but, or maybe it's Bertie Ahern, and the Irish-American members of the U.S. Senate. Joe's first appearance on stage was at the tender age of 15. Since then, he has appeared in productions as diverse as Madame Butterfly, The Silver Tassie, Aida, Macbeth, Oklahoma, and Guys and Dolls. Let's see. So, and it goes on about some of his other accomplishments, and there are some YouTube links and links to other recordings. And man, Joe, you have a great voice. I too sing tenor in my church choir, but nothing like the way you sing. Yeah, you got a beautiful operatic voice. So, thanks for sending in your feedback to me, a lowly airline pilot, and I appreciate hearing from you more in the future. And maybe one of these days when I'm over in Dublin, maybe we can share a pint of Guinness together. Okay, and I also have some more voice feedback, this time from Beth Spellacy, who called my feedback line, which is area code 1-304-99-PILOT. That's 304-997-4568. And here is Beth.
Hi, Captain Jeff. This is Beth Spellacy from Staten Island, New York. I wanted to just give a fast call to let you know how amazed I was and enthralled I was at your last podcast, your new podcast, actually. What used to be Catholic Pilot is new Airline Pilot Guy. 001. It was really nice to hear your background in how you got into aviation in the first place. You might have done it a while ago, and even though I have known about you and your podcast for a while, this was some facts that I didn't really know about. So it was great hearing some facts about you and how you got into this line of work. And I have to say, as I said before, I was very enthralled by your update of Air France 447 and in what they had found. And as I'm listening to it, it was really, it was like I was watching it the way you were describing it. And it was very interesting. And that says a lot, coming from someone who, before your podcast, never really had any interest at all in aviation. It was just something that never really caught my eye in any way. And I just wanted to say thank you. I love learning new things, and I love hearing about interesting things like that. It's a very, what I always thought was a very dangerous line of work, but I'm finding that it is also extremely interesting. But God bless. Thank you again for your podcast and for all that you do. And I'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you, Beth. And by the way, Beth and her husband Mike have a new podcast. And my, they've been cranking out, seems like, a couple podcasts every week. Probably not quite that many, but they're already up to episode number 8. It's entitled The Tightrope. Again, that's Beth and Mike Spellacy. They're from Staten Island, New York, and they talk about all kinds of things happening in their life and their kids' lives. So check it out at The Tightrope, thetightrope.net. And thanks for your feedback, Beth, and I'm glad that, you know, I try to make this show something that's appealing to listen to by both pilots and non-pilots alike. And I try to remember that I can't get too technical with everything, because not everybody understands all the aviation lingo and that kind of thing. But I think it's true with anything. The more you know about something and somebody's job, the more you understand and the better you feel about it. So I think that people listening to the show, if you're like a white-knuckle flyer, then the more you learn about what we do and what our job entails, I think you're armed with that knowledge, and it makes things not so stressful when you get onto airplanes and such. So anyway, thanks again, Beth. Look forward to hearing more from you. And yeah, I promised I was going to send you some feedback to your podcast. I'll try to do that soon. It's probably why she sent it to me, because she's trying to make me feel bad. So there we go. That's feedback from Beth. Okay, let's see. What else did I want to talk about here? Oh, I saw this. Let me get my screen up here from Evernote. That's the software I use to kind of keep track of some of the things I want to talk about on the show. Great application, by the way, evernote.com, free, unless you use a lot of stuff. The article from USA Today, I was reading this in the USA Today newspaper. You ever wonder what happens to leftover soap and shampoo at hotels? I do. You know, I stay in hotels 3-4 nights a week. And, you know, they give us a shampoo bottle and usually 2 bars of soap and conditioner, usually lotion, sometimes even mouthwash and who knows what. I've always wondered, because when I use shampoo, I don't have a lot of hair. And I know I fly with guys that don't have any. You know, they have shaved their heads. So I don't think they use any shampoo at all. I'm wondering about, of course, that I understand. If you don't open up the bottle of shampoo, obviously they can just take that and, you know, use it for the next guest. But what about people like me? I take the the shampoo bottle, open it up, squirt a little bit in my hand, wash my hair, and that's it. You know, there that the rest of that bottle of shampoo sits. Or I use that bar of soap. You know, I take one shower, wash my hands a couple times, and most of that bar of soap is still there. Well, it turns out that there are a couple organizations now that are actually recycling some of this product. Oh, I hear a helicopter in the background here, probably Marine Corps One heading to the White House. Anyway, I don't know if you can hear that or not, but they're already past us. Anyway, the article goes on to say that the shampoo and soaps, etc., most are thrown away. About 1 million partly used bars of soap are tossed out daily. Daily? About 1 million partly used bars tossed out daily by U.S. hotels, according to Clean the World Foundation, a nonprofit organization that recycles used soap for distribution to developing nations and homeless shelters. So Clean the World is based in Orlando, and the Global Soap Project, based in Atlanta, are starting to get more attention from large hotel companies. And Clean the World said last week it reached an agreement with Starwood Hotels to recycle soap, shampoo, and lotion. They estimate about 1.6 million pounds of soap may be recycled each year because Starwood has about 176,000 rooms in North America. Starwood runs Westin, Sheraton, and other hotel chains. And let's see, I think they charge hotels 65 cents a room to clean and redistribute soap and shampoo bottles. It's a, so they give the soap, the reused or recleaned or whatever you want to term it, soap to organizations, charities, and that kind of thing. Let's see. It distributed more than 8 million bars of soap in the United States and more than 40 countries, including Haiti, Japan, Zimbabwe, Uganda, India, and Mexico. It estimates its efforts have diverted about 550 tons of waste from polluting landfills in the U.S. and Canada. Each day, 9,000 children die from diseases that can be prevented by washing with soap, the organization says. So, that's cool. I'm glad to see that there are some organizations out there that are doing something with this product. Now, honestly, you know what I do? My used bottles of shampoo and conditioner and lotion, I don't throw them away. I actually take them, put them in a plastic bag, and take them with me, and use them when I get home. So I try not to let any of that stuff go to waste myself. But it's good to see that there are organizations out there like Clean the World and the Global Soap Project, and they're out there keeping the stuff out of our landfills and giving it to people who are in need. Okay, well, I'm looking at my list of things I wanted to talk about, and I think that that pretty much takes care of it. Again, if you have any comments regarding... Oh, you know what? There is one more thing I wanted to talk about. The first day of my trip, we ended up... we were supposed to go from Atlanta to Cincinnati, Cincinnati to Orlando, Orlando to Hartford, Connecticut. And... somewhere en route between Atlanta and Cincinnati, we got a message on our in-flight data. It's like an email system. It's called an ACARS. And there was a message there that said we had a reroute. A reroute is when they say, well, instead of doing what you thought you were going to do, this is what you're really going to do. And then you have to acknowledge the reroute so that they know that you got the message. And what they said was, instead of doing what we were originally supposed to do, we were going to fly from Cincinnati to Fort Myers, then back to Cincinnati, and then we were going to deadhead from Cincinnati to Hartford. Now, of course, many of you know that deadheading means when they put air crew members on an airplane as passengers just to get us repositioned so that we can, you know, pick up the rest of our trip. And so after waiting around for a couple hours after we got back to Cincinnati, we got on a Comair flight to Hartford-Bradley International Airport, which is actually Windsor Locks, Connecticut. And it's a small airplane, a regional jet, 50 passenger. And there was a little altercation, I'd say, a verbal altercation between the lone flight attendant and this young kid. I say young kid, he's probably, I'd say late teens or early 20s. And he, you know, before you push back from the gate, you hear the announcement from the flight attendants that you need to power off all of your electronic devices, unless they're an electronic device that is keeping you alive. Obviously, we don't want you to turn those off. So that means your iPod, your BlackBerry, your iPhone, your iPad, your computer, all that kind of stuff needs to be actually turned off. Now, I'm not going to go into the merits or whatever of the reality of whether or not this really makes any difference at all. I think many of you know my personal opinion about this. I don't think that a device that's on really has any effect whatsoever on any of our airplanes' navigation systems. At least that's my anecdotal evidence over my 22 years of flying airliners. But regardless of that, it's a rule that the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, says that we must comply with and that we must ensure that our passengers are complying with. Okay, so whether it's right or wrong, it's a rule, and we have to enforce it. So she made her announcement, and this kid basically, you know, was still doing something on his phone or his iPod or whatever. It must have been a phone, iPhone. And she said, you know, you need to power that off, sir. And he made some kind of a wisecrack. I wasn't sure exactly what he said because I was sitting about two or three rows behind. And she said, no, being in air mode or airline mode, which turns off the antennas and the transmission and reception aspect of the device, she said that that's not good enough. It has to be powered completely down. Okay, well, he made some kind of a crack like, well, no, it doesn't have any effect. And again, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's called respecting authority. If the authority says that you are to turn it off, then turn the darn thing off instead of being a smart aleck about it. I tell you, this guy, he doesn't know how close he was to being kicked off the airplane. She made a call to the cockpit. The captain came on and made another announcement about it. I yelled from my row, a couple of rows back, to turn it off, hopefully sounding a little bit authoritative. And I was this close, I'm holding up my fingers, this close to getting up and getting in this guy's face and telling him, look, have some respect for this flight attendant and what she's asking you to do, and we can talk about whether or not this is right or wrong, you know, at the bar or somewhere else, but not now. We need to push back from the gate and get this flight in the air. We all need to get to Bradley International Airport, but, you know, come on, let's use some good manners, okay? And let's have some respect for our fellow mankind. And think about, you know, he could have just said, you know, done something and made it look like he was turning it off and said, look, it's off. And that would have been complying, in my opinion. But instead, he had to make some kind of a wisecrack remark. And that's what really got my goat, the fact that he was just so disrespectful. I tell you, if any of my kids acted like that, you know, they would be in trouble. Anyway, so I thought I'd just mention that. Let's, you know, keep cool heads about ourselves out there. Let's respect authority when it's appropriate and be good citizens and love each other. How about that? Okay, and that wraps up the show. If you have anything to say about anything I talked about on the show, again, feedback is 304-99-PILOT or feedback at airlinepilotguy.com. Be sure to visit my website and follow me. I'm Airline Pilot Guy on Twitter and Captain Jeff, that's CaptJeff or Airline Pilot Guy on Facebook. And until next time, I wish you blue skies, unlimited visibility, and tailwinds. Take care and God bless.